Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the latest in the disappearance of a University of Utah student, the lawsuit filed by the parents of a U student murdered 8 months ago, the Salt Lake City mayoral primary debate, and more. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer. Thanks
good
for being here.
Good morning.
Reporter Taylor Stevens is here with us as well, and good morning to you, Taylor.
Good morning, Roger.
We've also got reporter Nate Carlisle in studio, and welcome to you as well, Nate.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. The number to call listeners to join this conversation is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet questions and comments to us at KCPW is our handle. And we will begin this week with some news that has dominated the headlines for a great deal of the week and for longer, I believe. That is the disappearance of a 23-year-old University of Utah student. And Nate Carlisle, remind us of sort of the sketch details of this case, when Mackenzie Lueck disappeared and the context around that disappearance, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I mean, it's one of the stranger disappearances we've had in a city that's had a lot of missing young women and woman cases. So she lands at Salt Lake City International Airport about 1:30 a.m. on June 17. She was returning from her grandmother's funeral in California. And she gets off the plane. There's police have released video and still photos of surveillance photos at the airport. And then she orders a Lyft, the ride-sharing company Lyft. And instead of taking her home near Trolley Square in Salt Lake City, it takes her to a whole nother county, actually, North Salt Lake and Hatch Park. And she gets out there about 3 a.m. And police say she met someone else there and got into another car. And that's really the last anyone saw of her and knows where she's been. No one reported her missing until 3 days later. And there's been a hard search to try to find her. Her friends have been handing out flyers. Police have been serving search warrants in the case. And this week, that looked like a big development when they served a search warrant at a house near the Fair Park. But no arrests have been made. Police took some evidence. They haven't said what it was.
There were some, early on, the police were asking, I mean, I guess maybe I should ask you what they were saying about this case, because they weren't treating it at the beginning of this, when we learned about this, as a sort of urgent thing. They were looking at it as they had no reason to believe that there was any harm that had come to her and so on. Can you talk about the police response to this?
Well, police said they had no evidence of foul play. In fact, the chief said that as recently as yesterday. Despite the search warrant, there's still no evidence of foul play. However, that doesn't mean they weren't looking for her this whole time. Her friends have said police were out asking around people at the Utah Arts Festival last weekend, for example. Mm-hmm. And, police did eventually get a search warrant to, I would assume, they haven't said this, search her cell phones and other digital evidence of where she may have gone. It's not like they weren't trying to find her. They were just very cautious in choosing their words, saying that we don't have evidence of foul play. She is an adult. She might have just chosen to go somewhere else on her own. Now, a lot of the circumstantial evidence tells us that's probably not the case. Mm-hmm. But and the longer she goes missing, the more it looks like something's amiss here.
The police were also asking if anyone knew whether Lueck had a second phone or other social media accounts. Why were police asking those questions, Nate? Is that a common thing? I mean,
I wouldn't say it's common. No. She's an adult, so I think police were pondering the possibility she could have gone off the grid, as it's said. Mm. There's also been some discussion of her dating life, so they thought, and given that, she did try to meet someone at 3 a.m., they thought maybe she could have, met someone she was involved with somehow, and they weren't aware of that. I don't know where she is. Police don't know where she is, so they're clearly trying to consider all possibilities.
There was also a moment where they were asking in their public statements for her to come forward if she was out there of her own accord. And again, that points to them maybe thinking that, at the outset that, she had just gone of her own will.
Yes. I mean, and that isn't terribly unusual of an adult that goes missing with no obvious evidence of foul play. They will ask, you know, so-and-so, if you can hear us, in this case, Mackenzie Lewick, if you can hear us, please check in. Please let us know you're okay. But that's not uncommon.
Okay. So then, as you said, there was sort of a development on, I think it was Wednesday night, when police conduct a sort of operation or a search of a house in the Rose Park area here in Salt Lake City, actually very near to the Utah Fair Park. What do we know about that search, Nate? I mean, it's you know, she went to North Salt Lake, as you said, and then this is back here in Salt Lake, even closer to the airport. What do we know about this search?
Not a lot. The search warrants have not been released, so we don't know what the police told a judge to get a search warrant. We do know that they were there a long time. They were there better than 12 hours, taking evidence from the home and from a detached garage and from the backyard. I was there pretty late, and I saw them carry shovels into the backyard. They were digging something out of the backyard and putting them in sacks and carrying them out. But they haven't said what they found and whether it's useful in pinpointing where Mackenzie Lewick is or what happened to her.
Is it? And police aren't saying whose house it is or who was living in this house?
They haven't given the name of the homeowner, no. Yeah. I mean, the public record search and other materials tells you who it is. We haven't reported the name yet because, again, no one said that they suspect him of being guilty of anything. They've called him a person of interest. I mean, it's not like a mystery who owns the house. Police know who owns the house.
As far as recovering evidence goes, you said that police, as recently as I think you said yesterday, said they don't have any evidence of there being
foul play. The word the chief used.
Okay, but you talked about those evidence bags. Is there anything that we know about the evidence what I'm wondering is, can we go any further than what you've described so far? Is there any working theory that police are offering, or is it just a kind of crickets being quiet?
If you want to make inferences about what the police suspect, and go ahead. I mean, they're still asking the public for help. They're trying to find this mattress and box spring that the homeowner gave away here a week or so ago. I think it's fair to say they suspect something happened in the house. Whether they're correct is another matter. Again, the homeowner hasn't been arrested. He hasn't been charged. And police obviously don't know everything that happened to Mackenzie Lewick.
I want to bring Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, in on this conversation. And, this story has really captivated the news cycle over the past, six days. And I want to get into the story and sort of your opinions on the story. But what about just the idea that it has been that captivating? Is it just the mysterious aspect of this, that we don't know what happened for the reason that it has been such a big news story?
Well, there are a few questions surrounding this. Maybe, Nate, you can offer some insight into this. The police said that it was now a digital forensics operation. I don't even know what that means, especially when they're carrying out bags and bags and carrying shovels. I mean, it does pique the interest. Like, there seems to be some weird disconnect. Can you just tell me what digital forensics means?
Yeah, it's definitely government speak, isn't it? Basically, they're searching her cell phone records. They're searching her computer records. They're searching third-party computer records. You know, if she accessed any websites, they're probably trying to get information from those. I promise you, they're looking for surveillance cameras anywhere they have them. I had a homicide detective tell me years ago that when they get called out, the first thing they do is look around to figure out where the cameras are.
Mm-hmm.
They took camera footage from the Salt Lake City International Airport, for example. And they probably have tried to figure out all over town which cameras were operating those early hours of June 17. So it's that kind of thing when they're talking about digital, basically they're looking for it at any foot, I don't want to keep using the word digital, but some electronic, some evidence of where she was in those hours, short of the old-fashioned thumbprint somewhere, or finding her clothing or luggage or something like that. They're not necessarily looking for something tangible they're looking for something very 21st century.
And I think that lends to the, you know, mysterious nature of this. It seems to be, at least to accounts from her family and her close friends, that this is totally out of character for her to miss a wedding, to miss obligations in school. To have this 3 a.m. call to the middle of a neighborhood that her friends and family didn't know that she had association with. So I think that is one piece of this puzzle. The other piece I think is a little bit more troubling. And last weekend we had an excellent story from my colleague Erin Alberti, who started her story with a question. And the question was, how important does a person have to be for their community to notice when he or she disappears? We have missing people all the time. I mean, so what is it that raises the red flags? Erin's story really highlighted the case of a young man who had been in and out of law enforcement, had stints of homelessness. And so when he was reported missing, like you said, crickets, there was just not a lot of interest there. The police didn't, raise the alarm bells because there was a pattern. But it does raise some troubling questions for us to examine, how the media responds, how law enforcement responds when somebody goes missing. And is the story overplayed? I think all of those questions are legitimate to consider at this point.
Right. And I was going to draw attention to Erin's reporting on that. I mean, this young man's body was found in the Jordan River.
That's right.
And that was, it didn't make the splash that this disappearance has. And I don't know. I mean, who's Nate? I'm going to turn to you, though, actually now and just ask for, going back to this original story, what comes next in it? I mean, there are obvious pieces that we're waiting on, namely, the big one, where what actually happened. But any expectations of how this might play out, or is that too much projecting?
Well, there could be a resolution by the time we walk out of the studio here.
Right.
It could go on days, weeks, months. I mean, it's just a matter of, do they get the tip? Does the information they've gotten through subpoenas and search warrants yield her location? Does she all of a sudden call or text in saying, hey, I'm fine. I've been in, on a hike in southern Utah for the last 10 days. I mean, who knows what could happen here? There's a lot of possibilities. I'm still covering the Susan Powell case. I mean, we're still waiting for the big clue in that case to yield what actually happened to Susan Cox Powell. So I have no idea how this is going to be resolved or when. And we've had conversations at the Tribune that, look, we would like her found safely just like everyone else would, but we're also been kind of thinking long term this week about how we cover this going forward.
Mm-hmm. Because you don't know exactly what the future holds, obviously. Nate Carlisle, that is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter, thank you very much for your coverage on this. And we're going to head to our first break in the show, and when we return, we will turn to some other news from this past week in Utah news. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce and Nate Carlisle and Taylor Stevens. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can tweet us at KCPW. Jennifer Napier Pierce, we were just talking about the disappearance of a University of Utah student, a young woman. And the fear in many quarters is that something tragic has happened, though, again, we don't know what happened. Something tragic did happen to another University of Utah student last October, though. This is Lauren McCluskey, who was murdered on campus by an estranged boyfriend who had been essentially hiding his true identity from her, and he later killed himself. There have been criticisms over the way that the university handled the case of Lauren McCluskey, both in the lead-up to her death and afterwards. From how they treated the event. And the latest development here is that the McCluskeys, the parents of Lauren McCluskey, that is, are suing the university. Just Jennifer Napier Pierce, if you could, can you tell us about the lawsuit that the McCluskeys have filed and what it says?
Yeah, so they filed a lawsuit yesterday suing the University of Utah for $56 million in a civil rights case. They are claiming that the department did not respond appropriately, that they were negligent in their duties, that the university has not taken appropriate action to ensure student safety while on campus, and no apology. So they've filed this suit, they say, to bring attention to these issues, and they also want to devote any result, financial result, to campus safety at the U.
So any settlement that may happen, or any whatever they recoup from this lawsuit. The lawsuit is also based in part on an independent report that came out earlier this year that was critical to a certain extent of how the University of Utah handled this case. Am I right about that?
Yeah. A couple months after Lauren's death, a three-member panel, I believe it was two former law enforcement. Yeah. I think there was step in, Nate.
State Department of Public Safety, and then a police chief, former campus police chief, who now runs an association of campus police chiefs,
right,
were the review panel.
Right. So they filed a scathing report, actually. I mean, it highlighted very, very clearly what the shortcomings of this department were: inadequate training, no cross-campus communications between housing authorities, the Title IX office, police. It's sort of this ongoing litany of shortcomings in the response. It was interesting to see how the University of Utah president, Ruth Watkins, responded. She did not hold any officer responsible. She still hasn't. And I think that is another reason why the McCluskeys went this route to go through legal means.
Didn't the university president, didn't she also say that Lauren McCluskey's death wasn't preventable? I mean, at one point she came out and said, we couldn't have stopped this from happening. That was something, maybe Nate Carlisle, you can weigh in.
That's accurate. Yes, yeah, okay. She did say that at one point. I think it was something to the tune of the report shows that there were factors here that made this not preventable.
The actual quote, while there are differences in how we would characterize some of the events leading to Lauren's tragic murder, let me say again that we share the McCluskey family's commitment to improving campus safety. So that's her response to the lawsuit.
Okay.
And it very much echoes what she said last December.
There was also this, just going back to the university's response, there was also this awards ceremony that the University of Utah held, where some people involved in campus safety were given awards for how this case was handled. And that, I know, also drew the criticism of the McCluskey family.
Sure. So several of the officers, I believe it was the detective who was involved, followed up with the McCluskey family after Lauren's death, and they were commended for those actions. I think it was labeled as compassionate. The McCluskeys took extreme umbrage with that action. They thought it was insulting. I think Matt McCluskey called it obscene, and they just thought that was really tone deaf on the part of the university and its police department.
You said that any money that came from this case, if this lawsuit proves successful, would go into a foundation. Can you talk about that foundation at all, or what the purpose of it is?
I believe it's devoted to student athletes, and they want to make sure that other future student athletes don't have to go through this. They want to honor Lauren McCluskey's passions. I think one of them was for animal care, and student athletes.
There's another part of the story, that plays into this, and that's that the University of Utah paid for public relations help on this case, $60,000. How was that money spent? This was to put a public face on the work they were doing, or on their response to the McCluskey tragedy?
Yeah, that's a story that Courtney Tanner broke yesterday, just based on some documents that she received in a records request. Basically, the university, I think it was the day after Lauren's death, reached out to this crisis communication firm out of Texas. They've used them before. This is, as Courtney's story highlights, I mean, this is common practice for a lot of large institutions that are facing troubling cases. The advice that this particular consultant gave to the university was, you know, be careful around making it about race, be careful about talking about her behavior, but they used some really derogatory terms, including slut-shaming. So that's some troubling information that we had not heard of before, and I think that it underscores some of the concerns that the McCluskeys have on how the university responded and handled this case in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to put on your editorial board hat and then I was going to ask you if that was, you know, money well spent on the university's part, $60,000. I mean, it actually seems, you know, compared to the university's full budget, $60,000 seems like a drop in the bucket.
It's a drop in the bucket. So, you know, I don't think it's misuse of funds or anything, but I'm not sure. Again, with my editorial hat, I don't think that this was real sound advice. It did seem tone deaf in some ways. You know, some of the sentences that came out of that report or the email exchanges that this consultant had with the U. I'm surprised at the guidance that they gave to administrators about how to speak about this case. In particular, I'm not sure why President Watkins has really remained behind closed doors. Dateline did a huge thing on this a few weeks ago. She was not present. She sent somebody else to make the big apology. The McCluskeys in their suit allege that she's gone radio silent, that she has not responded to their requests. And that's why they're taking this legal action, is because they have not gotten a response from her. So all of that leads me to believe that, gosh, you know, what is going on in terms of accountability on campus?
One of the things that the McCluskey family points out is that Lauren McCluskey had been making phone calls, repeated phone calls to police, both campus police, and then when she wasn't getting the response she wanted from, I guess, campus police, she was going to Salt Lake City police as well, but that kind of went unheeded. I mean, it did go unheeded, and that's part of the negligence they see from the university's side. I don't know where – there's a lawsuit that's been filed over this. Is there a chance that this will get settled outside of court, Jennifer?
There's always a chance, right? People don't like to go into open court. If the University of Utah is smart, again, my editorial hat, they will settle this. It's just bad publicity all the way around. But I think that in order for the McCluskeys to settle, at least according to their statements, the university has to hold somebody accountable. And so far, the police chief is still there. Their staff is pretty intact. They're giving awards. I think that the University of Utah, if they want this to go away, needs to show some appropriate action and demonstrate that, yes, they have sensitivity training on the staff. Yes, they've added a victim's advocate. And yes, you know, somebody was responsible for the lack of training in the first place. And that likely will be the police chief, Chief Brophy.
That's Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier Pierce. There's probably a lot more we could go into in this story, but just in the interest of time, I'm going to move us on to other topics from this past week's news. A reminder to listeners that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Let's move now to the story of let's go to some mayoral politics, actually. Taylor Stevens and the race that is going on to replace Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski. And actually, you know what, before we go into the race itself, I'd love to get an update on a topic that is a big issue in that race. This is the Utah Inland Port. You actually this week reported on Mayor Jackie Biskupski's updated lawsuit over the port project. Can you remind us what the lawsuit is and then tell us about the changes that happened this week to that lawsuit?
Yeah, so what the lawsuit is the mayor basically contesting the state's takeover of 19,000 acres of land in the city's northwest quadrant to create a distribution hub. As a result of that decision, which was made through legislation last year, last session, the city will lose its zoning and taxing authority for the area, which are functions that are usually within kind of municipal control. So what the mayor is saying here is that the state has overstepped its bounds and that they are seeking a return of that control to the city. The reason that the lawsuit had to be updated, the original lawsuit was filed in March, right on the heels of a new bill that was going to be passed that she feared would take away her ability to sue. In one of the bills that came forward on this issue, it would have taken the authority away from a city administration to file a lawsuit without permission of the legislative body, which, if you've been following this at all, you know that the city council and the mayor are not exactly in step on this issue.
Right.
So the reason that this was updated was because that bill eventually did pass and has created some new parameters around the port project.
That's basically expanding it into other communities as well.
And also, making some changes around how long the state can kind of take over taxing increment authority and things like that.
And then she also asked the court for an injunction that would, if the court accepted it, that would basically hit the pause button on the development of the port.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the big new thing in this lawsuit. And we kind of expected this lawsuit to come. We reported 2 weeks ago the mayor kind of making this promise to bring this forward. But the injunction is new, and we'll see kind of where that goes as this moves through the courts. It probably will continue beyond her administration to whoever is elected as the new mayor.
Okay. I'm just going to quickly plug a KCPW program here. Our program In the Hive took a look at that injunction, also at some vastly differing viewpoints on the Utah Inland Port from protesters and from an industry lobbyist. Check that out at kcpw.org. And then with that update on the Inland Port out of the way, let's turn to the race to replace Mayor Jackie Biskupski, who announced that she's not running for re-election. You've been profiling the candidates, all eight of them, Taylor, and you attended a debate on Wednesday. Debates are hard to summarize, but maybe I will ask, how did the candidates try to distinguish themselves from the field, if they did do that?
Yeah, this was a really
hang on 1 second. I'm going to have you switch microphones for just a quick moment. And onward, Taylor Stevens.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah.
This was an interesting debate. You had seven of the eight candidates there. One candidate, Rainer Huck, was not able to attend and had a stand-in, which was pretty unusual. The way that you saw this kind of play out was very much about personality. Most of these candidates are more liberal, more progressive, and they have similar ideas, and some of them have even signed on to specific policies together. But what you saw was kind of this personality question of, I have the experience with the state, or I have the experience with the city, or I have the experience with business. And so each candidate was kind of trying to present themselves as the best person to bring forward what in many ways seems like a collective vision for the city.
I mean, are they very far apart from each other on specific policy aims? You wrote that, for example, that air quality took center stage at the debate. What sort of ideas were the candidates throwing around to tackle air pollution problems in the city? And then I will ask you how far apart they are on general policy positions.
Yeah, so we see the two candidates in this race who have state legislative experience, and that's former Senator Jim DeBacchus and current state Senator Luz Escamilla. They kind of bring their state hats to this race, I think, and advocate for working with the legislature to bring some movement forward on this issue. They say we don't live in an island, that we've got to work together to address this big issue. So Jim DeBacchus, for example, wants to work with the state to get more money from the transportation budget, the road budget, to put into making transit in Salt Lake City free for all residents here. That would require some state cooperation. Then you have candidates like former Salt Lake City Councilman Stan Penfold, who says, you know, we're not going to make any headway with the state as a minority party. What we need to do is really work with other municipalities in the valley and as Salt Lake City to push this forward as much as we can, and we need to take ownership of the things that we can do. Interestingly, he is also pushing for free fare UTA, and so it's kind of different approaches to some of the same policy prescriptions.
That interesting, there was that repeated line from a few candidates, and you mentioned Luz Escamilla and Senator Jim DeBacchus, former Senator Jim DeBacchus, but about liaising with the state and that the city needs to work with the state to get certain things done. That line from Stan Penfold, as I remember it, drew some laughs, the idea that, you know, there's this supermajority of the GOP at the Utah State Legislature, and the city, I don't know, I guess maybe traditionally or historically hasn't had a lot of power over the state.
Yeah, it's funny because we talked a little earlier about the inland port being a campaign issue. So on the one hand, you have candidates saying, I'm going to fight the state on this issue and I'm going to be the advocate for Salt Lake City. And then you have candidates turning around and saying, you know, we need to have a really good relationship with the state and I'm the person who's going to make that happen. And so, you know, everybody kind of wants it both ways. But at the end of the day, you know, how that will really play out, it may be a question of personality in some ways. We haven't seen Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Viskupski have the best luck working with the state, and she was a former legislator, so it's hard to say.
I want to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Have you made your choice for which candidate you are supporting in the Salt Lake City mayor's race? You can also tweet us at KCPW with your questions, comments, and so on. We led with that story about the inland port, and you just brought it up. But what did get said in general about the inland port at this debate? Were the candidates, you know, backing that lawsuit from Mayor Jackie Viskupski, and then more generally, what are their sentiments on the port?
Yeah, so I want to plug a special tool that we've put together for the Salt Lake City mayor's race. We have on our website, you can find it at sltrib.com/slc-mayor-race. We have profiles of all eight candidates, and then we have all of the candidates side by side on the record on some of the major issues in this race, including transportation, affordable housing, air quality, homelessness, and the inland port. And yeah, the candidates did speak to the inland port during this debate, and we have almost all of those candidates in favor of the lawsuit moving forward. I believe Rainer Huck said that he would not move that forward, as well as I believe Richard Goldberger, and I'm checking that right now. He does not support the lawsuit moving forward. So there's two candidates in this race that have that stance. Yeah, it's an interesting issue.
It is an interesting issue, and I don't want to belabor the point, but there was also the idea that there's the lawsuit, but then there's the idea that the city needs to work with the state on that project. Did anybody say something, you know, strikingly different on the port project when it comes to, I don't know, that seat at the table conversation about the port?
Yeah, there's candidates who, like Stan Penfold, who say that we need to work with the state to ensure that this is net zero emissions. So in other words, that it is green and sustainable. And then there's other candidates like David Garbette, who is the former executive director of the Pioneer Park Coalition and was a staff attorney at the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, who say, you know, we don't need an inland port. Our economy is good. And let me offer an alternative to this project. And again, how much power they really have to change this conversation with the state, you know, who knows? But that they're certainly putting that out there as a big policy idea.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor. On the idea of working with the state over the port, the city has this lawsuit, and that lawsuit is essentially over the states having come in and taken control of city land. What does that say about the city and state working together? There's maybe a little bit of an imbalance in power, especially on this particular topic.
This is nothing new for Salt Lake City. I think the capital city has always had problems with the Capitol Hill. So, think about the rocky relationship that Rocky Anderson had. You know, I just think that there's always been this us versus them mentality. It continues today. I don't know if any single person can make that history go away. Perhaps. I mean, one can always wish. But, I do think it is interesting to hear some of the perspectives from these candidates. Former Senator Jim DeBacchus, he was known as a bomb thrower on Capitol Hill, so he's not exactly the diplomatic sort. Now that he wants to play nice with the state capitol, okay, you know, we'll see. The proof will be in the pudding. I do think that each one will bring certain things to the table. They all need to fight for the capital city's interests, however, because the state legislature is overwhelmingly not Democrat, not Republican, and that's the majority of the state legislature. So I just think that there's some inherent ideological barriers that whoever is mayor is going to have to overcome.
Hmm. I want to go back to the debate for just a quick moment here, Taylor Stevens, because there were a couple of, I guess I'd call them, you know, unusual aspects of the debate. One is that one of the candidates sent somebody else in his stead, meaning he had someone debate on his behalf. Can you talk about that part of this?
Yeah, Rainer Huck, and as we mentioned earlier, he had a stand-in because he had an asthma attack. Ironically, he said he did not think air quality was an important issue in this race. Hmm. But yeah, so that was interesting because at times you couldn't
tell. His stand-in said that or he said that?
Well, his stand-in said that the campaign felt that way. Mm. And that was kind of the difficult thing about having a stand-in is that at times we couldn't tell if the stand-in was speaking kind of his own policy views or speaking on behalf of the campaign. And I mean, either way, it got a sixth of the time. Right. So that was interesting to see.
The stand-in, and I can't remember his name, but he said basically
Abby Olofoku, okay. And I might be saying that wrong.
He said that, air quality was a distraction from more important topics, including police shootings.
Yeah, so he said, quote, the Huck campaign believes this air quality situation is a misdirection for the very serious issues such as police brutality, such as crime, etc.
Just on, I led with this concept of interesting tidbits from the debate. I want to now turn to, you mentioned this mayoral tool that you have at sltrip.com, where you are comparing candidates side by side. A lot of great policy positions, a lot of stances on things like the inland port or air quality and so on and so forth, and kind of general biographies. I have to just plug the fact that in these biographies are the names of candidates' pets. Can you tell us the names of different pets?
Yeah, so there's a few fun facts in here. Jim DeBacchus has four cats. Their names are Big White, Little White, Big Brown, and Little Brown. Luz Escamilla has a cat named Meow, and she has children, so she has a bit of an excuse there. There is also some just interesting facts. We asked candidates to give us, something voters don't know about them that's not necessarily related to the race. Richard Goldberger, who is a freelance journalist, told us that in his 75 years of life, he has had only one UFO experience. He doesn't really like to talk about it, though. And what else? David Ibarra likes to run marathons, so there's plenty of fun facts for people to scope through again at sltrip.com/slc-mayor-race.
Jennifer Napier Pierce, what people's pets say about whether or not you should vote for them is that I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that Erin Mendenhall, for example, I know pointed out that while she owns cats, she's a dog person. She said
that's the purest political statement I've ever heard. Wants to go both cats and dogs.
That's just playing both sides. I get it. So before we turn to another break here, I actually want to go to one other mayoral forum that you covered this past week, Taylor. And this was a mayoral forum on gun violence that the candidates attended. Who hosted that event and what happened at that forum?
Yeah, this was an interesting forum because the candidates got to speak on some issues that haven't really been central policy to the race. But we know that Salt Lake City and Utah has a really young population, and March for Our Lives Utah, which is a group that has emerged in the aftermath of the Parkland shooting in Florida, hosted the event, kind of the local March for Our Lives chapter. So this was an event organized by recent high school grads, and they wanted to talk to candidates about issues that affect young people primarily, like gun safety, school safety, and how the candidates are going to kind of include young voices in City Hall. So most of the mayoral candidates kind of advocated for action around these issues from state lawmakers and from the federal government, but they promised that they would kind of lead the charge and make space for young people to advocate for the issues that are important to them if they were elected. And they promised, you know, some kind of what they can do within their realm, which is work with the school officials to do kind of some violence prevention in Salt Lake City school districts to get more. I think it was Erin Mendenhall who pledged, a Salt Lake City councilwoman, who pledged to get more mental health professionals in Salt Lake City schools in an effort to address the suicide epidemic problems that we've seen here. And so they kind of talked about some, I think, issues that for them maybe weren't like top of mind before, and it was really interesting to see.
Can I just chime in? One thing that I thought was really interesting about this conversation that has not happened in Salt Lake City politics before, we have two Latinos who are running for the top seat. And they brought their perspectives on racial profiling and protecting kids of color because statistically they are more likely to be victims of violence. And that is not a perspective that has been at the top of people's thinking. And I think part of it is because they have not been represented in the political scene as prominently as previously. So that was just one thing that stuck out to me in your coverage, Taylor, was just the conversation has changed because of the diversity in this slate of candidates.
Yeah, State Senator Luz Escamilla, you know, talked about racial profiling. She said, "To me, it's personal. I'm afraid when my kids don't come home thinking that they're driving and something will happen to them because of the color of their skin." So we do have a diverse slate of candidates, and I think that's really going to push these conversations forward and more into the campaign at large.
There was this acknowledgement, I mean, you pointed out the acknowledgement that the city can't do much when it comes to gun policy or gun laws, that the state or federal government have the legal jurisdiction there. And so, I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is how the March for Our Lives, you know, organization that put this on here in Utah, how they responded to that sort of, statement from the candidates.
I think they're glad just to see candidates kind of interacting with these issues and thinking critically about them and bringing them into their policy. Again, this comes to that issue of working with the state and how do you work with the state to push forward some of these initiatives that you'd want to see. But I think that, you know, young people are getting more involved in politics, we've seen since 2016, and that it would be smart for candidates to do their best to engage some of these populations to get them to the polls, because this primary is really going to say, you know, choose who goes into the general. And if they have some of those young people mobilized, that could make a big difference.
When does the primary happen, the mayoral primary?
August 13th.
And then it will be, as you said, two candidates from there forward until November.
Yep.
Jen, anything you're looking forward to before we head to a break in the mayoral election?
I was surprised at how the agendas have a lot of overlap. There's a lot in common between these candidates. I think what distinguishes them is personality and their individual focus. Like, you know, some have staked out air quality, some have staked out transportation as their pet project, and I think that's all really good. I think the overall perception of mine, at least coming out of the debate, was we have some really qualified candidates in Salt Lake City, which is a good thing. I think voters have some homework to do as they approach this primary, but UFO visits notwithstanding, I mean, you know.
Difficult choices to make.
Yeah, difficult choices.
All right. Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for covering the Salt Lake City mayor's race for us. We're going to head to a quick break here, and then when we come back, I think we'll probably turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce, Taylor Stevens, and Nate Carlisle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and I would say call in with your questions and comments, except for that we are nearing the end of the show here, and we're going to turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, a chance to highlight some stories that we didn't cover on the show today. And maybe I will start with Nate Carlisle, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
I'm taking reporter Jessica Miller's investigations and articles about Red Rock Canyon School in St. George and the ridiculous amount of abuse that went on there by the staff. I mean, there have been staff members charged with child abuse. And I'd say this was a case of inmates running the asylum, except I'm not sure who the inmates were here, if it was the kids or the staff. But this is a story that's important for something else, because it shows us what we've lost in this state with the decline of reporters in this state. I've been driving past Red Rock Canyon School for years. It's right on the main drag in St. George. It's just a block or two away from the St. George Spectrum. And it took a riot at that school with the cops being called out before any reporters started asking, what is going on at this place? And we have a hard time articulating what people don't get when we keep losing reporters in this state. And here's an example. This school has gone unchecked for years. I think it's in part because there weren't journalists asking what was happening there.
There's a remarkable part of the story, and this is Courtney Tanner's reporting, that shows that over the past 2 years, only 2 months, or yeah, I think it was just 2 months, had instances in which the police were not called to the school.
I think it was actually Jessica Miller.
Oh, Jessica Miller. Sorry. Excuse me, Jessica. My apologies. But that's a remarkable statement on that. Great pick for underplayed story of the week, and maybe a commentary on the loss or the decline of local journalism. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I want to highlight a story by my colleague Benjamin Wood, following up on something we talked about on the show a few weeks ago. The Utah County Commission voted on Tuesday for a resolution stating that life begins at the moment of conception, opposing the loosening of restrictions on abortion, and declaring itself a safe haven for the unborn. We talked a few weeks ago when Riverton City Council had made this move, and it's sort of a trend that we've seen over the last few months, I would say, with a lot of local municipalities, county governments staking out their stances on various issues. On Tuesday, I reported that the Salt Lake County Council voted to urge the legislature to pass a conversion therapy bill. So we're seeing more and more...
A ban on conversion.
Exactly, yes, thank you. So we're seeing more and more municipalities and counties kind of staking out claims on some of these big social issues.
That's an interesting pick for underplayed story of the week from Taylor Stevens, and thank you for it. Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, what about you?
This story was reported by Courtney Tanner. This is a story about a high school graduate who, during the graduation ceremony, had three eagle feathers. She is Navajo, and she wanted to reflect her heritage that on her cap. And she, as she walked through the line to go to accept her diploma, she was told in no uncertain terms, take the feathers off. And these are actually federally protected eagle feathers that only Navajos and other Native tribes can possess. She felt it was very much part of her and her symbolism for her, making this celebration complete. The teacher absolutely refused, and she had to carry them in her hand. It's just another case of schools kind of coming down on expressions, personal expressions during graduation ceremonies. One of the, you know, the highlights for a lot of young people is to graduate from high school and to show who they are, whether or not that's a flower lei or whether or not that's a candy lei. A lot of school districts have just said, no, we don't want any expressions of individuality, heritage, or personality. I think, as my editorial hat is on, I think that this is outrageous. And as Utah becomes increasingly more diverse, school districts are going to have to admit that there are symbols that that reflect deeply held beliefs, cultural heritage, and it should not be a sense where they have to hide that identity.
Do you, just out of since we have a little bit of time, 30 seconds or so, but why the demand from different school districts or teachers at schools to not show that expression, that cultural expression, at graduation?
This is at Lehigh High School.
Yeah.
And other incidents throughout the state have been similar. Basically, they say they want this to be a formal ceremony, and they don't want any distractions. And I guess that's a distraction.
Okay. That's Jennifer Napier-Pierce's pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'm going to go with Utah Governor Gary Herbert yesterday at his KUED TV monthly news conference, requesting new rules for psychologists who practice gay conversion therapy. He's asking the state regulators to change the rules around that. There's reporting on that at sltrip.com as well. I want to thank Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Taylor Stevens, and Nate Carlisle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, for being here today. Thanks for joining us on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, and is heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to KCPW producer Tim Pierce for his help with operations today, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we will see you next week.